Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis in for Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of June 10, 2011. Adjustable rate mortgages are synonymous with a housing crisis, but some home buyers are taking a second look.
Not all ARM products are bad. I mean, we can just say that right out front.
And in a tough employment market, job seekers are going back to school to add to their resumes. But are those pricey vocational schools worth it?
But the thing with the for-profit colleges is that the problem is not enrollment, but it's graduation. And then actually being able to use the degree to get work.
We'll find out about new rules aimed at for-profit colleges. Plus, what if your boss was younger than you by decades?
I can have good managers that are older, good managers that are younger. It really just depends on the person.
The Changing Corner Office, that story and others, coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
At the peak of the housing boom, more than a third of American home loan applications were for adjustable rate mortgages. ARMs, for short, have interest rates that adjust over time. But as the housing market crashed, those ARMs smacked many homeowners with higher interest rates and payments, and ARMs fell to less than 1% of the market as the crisis set in. They became an option for the very rich or the very brave. Well, now with more competitive interest rates, the adjustable rate mortgage is making a comeback. Marketplace's Jeff Horwich reports.
When your reputation has been trashed as thoroughly as the adjustable rate mortgage, it can be hard to get people to take you seriously again. So it goes for Jennifer Larson, a senior loan officer with Home Street Bank in Portland, Oregon.
The fear of the product is more persuasive than the math for some customers.
Larson says even when the numbers on paper show thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars in savings compared with a fixed rate loan, most people run the other way.
People either don't understand how the conventional ARM works, don't want to understand, or are just so frightened that they're either not going to be able to sell their house or they might lose their job.
Hey, who's not scared of that stuff? And aren't ARMs practically synonymous with that subprime business that caused the housing crisis? Well,
not all ARM products are bad. I mean, we can just say that right out front.
Ed Nelson saw his share of bad ones at the nonprofit Minnesota Home Ownership Center. So-called exploding ARMs tricked out with deceptive teaser rates, prepayment penalties, interest rates that reset from 0 to 14%, all pushed on people who couldn't really afford a house to begin with.
Many of those products, thankfully, are out of the market and hopefully will never return. We can drive a stake through those products and never, ever let them come back.
Most ARM products that survived the slaughter are Dullsville by comparison and thoroughly mainstream. Belying their predatory reputation, many are even backed by the Federal Housing Administration. Alex Stenback is a mortgage banker who writes the blog Behind the Mortgage.
There's caps in place. There's protections for the consumer so that the interest rates typically don't rise more than 1% in any one adjustment period, which is normally a year. And over the life of the loan, they can't rise more than typically 5 points.
But an ARM, by definition, still involves that gamble, the risk that rates will go up. Fresh off the recession, the last thing many of us want is more risk in our lives. So people willing to roll the dice get a pretty steep discount. Right now, the rate on a typical 30-year fixed-rate loan is about 4.8%. Not bad. But ARM rates start at 3.8 and go down from there. By historical standards, the gap is huge.
You know, we're moving out. My in-laws start first home, so we're excited.
Brian Colonna is about to close on a house in Warminster, Pennsylvania, using a 5-1 ARM. That means his rate is fixed for 5 years, then adjusts each year after that. For those first 5 years, his monthly payment will be $300 less than with a fixed-rate loan.
We were able to get our payment down to what we could afford right now. You know, this way we have some money still kept in our savings and still be able to do things that need to be done to the house.
A calculation for Marketplace Money by iLoan Home Mortgage compares a 30-year fixed to a 7-1 ARM at today's rates. A borrower with a $150,000 loan saves almost $10,000 in those first 7 years. In a worst-case scenario, it would take 9 years of maximum rate increases after that to undo those savings. And most mortgages don't last that long. The average lifespan of a U.S. home loan is 6 to 7 years. Brian Colonna in Pennsylvania plans to refinance his in 2. But Ed Nelson of the Minnesota Home Ownership Center is worried by such exit plans.
Some of my warning bells are going off. The fact that people are being told all the time, you'll be able to refinance. You'll be able to get yourself out of this product in a year or two. And the more dangerous part is, don't worry, you won't be in the house long enough for this to adjust and hurt you.
Given the stagnant housing market, Nelson recommends your own personal stress test. If your rate went up as much as possible, as fast as possible, could you still afford it? And can you sleep soundly at night knowing your rate might go up? If you can, then perhaps it's worth giving at least a respectful glance to the adjustable rate mortgage. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace Money.
Later in the show, a look at the hot real estate market in China. There's a good chance you've seen a commercial or two from a pricey vocational school promising you a better future. Tuition at those schools is expensive, and there's a disproportionate number of students who attend those schools and then later default on their loans. So a few weeks ago, the Obama administration announced new rules aimed at for-profit colleges. Carmen Wong Ulrich is a personal finance journalist and author of The Real Cost of Living. Hi, Carmen.
Hello, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I want to talk about President Obama's proposal of pulling back financial aid for students at for-profit colleges. What's going on with that?
This is a big one. This has been a battle going on for a couple years, actually. And we saw a new stat out that gives you an idea of just how big and influential the business of for-profit colleges is. Up from 2000, 11 years ago, enrollment is up over 400%.
Wow.
And we're just in an economy where everyone's getting the message that you need to retrain yourself, you need to get a degree, you need to get a different degree in order to be wanted, you know, in the job market.
Well, and an easy degree, or an easier degree, right? You can do this from home.
Yes. Oh, and it fits into the working person's lifestyle. So,
yeah.
You know, you can do it from home, you can do it at night, whenever, on your time. But the thing with the for-profit colleges is that the problem is not enrollment, but it's graduation and then actually being able to use the degree to get work. And that's what's being questioned. And that's why, you know, the Obama administration is looking at this, because there's a 12% default rate on student loans in general. But almost half of the defaults are for-profit schools. And what they're finding is that folks are getting these degrees. They're taking out huge private loans and federal loans,
yeah,
and ending up not being able to get work to pay those loans. And a lot of folks have testified that, and this reminds me very much of bad mortgages, these student loans are kind of pushed on them. They don't feel like they're getting all the information. They don't really understand how it works. They're being told it's good debt. So they're taking on a lot more than they can chew, and it's bad news.
Is there a collusion going on there, do you think, Carmen?
Well, here's what I think. I think this is a mix of the market, what the economy and the job market are telling folks, what, you know, for-profit schools are exactly that. They are for-profit. And their stock prices, you know, when this regulation came through, if you can imagine, the stocks shot up.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say, well, why? My goodness, you know, the regulation, why would they?
Right, right.
Because the regulation is so much softer than was initially proposed several years ago. So what they're looking at here is these for-profit schools must have at least 35% of their borrowers must not default. So that means the majority of your borrowers can default.
Right, 65%.
Right, over 3 years. So it's kind of a soft regulation. Unfortunately, the schools cost, for-profit schools cost a lot. They cost much more than your local public or community schools. So that's why so much debt is being taken out.
What I don't want this to be is some sort of for-profit bash fest, right?
No.
Yeah. So because, I mean, obviously there are some success stories and a lot of folks who relish in their education from some of these schools. Do you have any of those stories?
Sure. I mean, absolutely. If you look at half or more of folks who take out those loans, do fine and repay those loans. So there's no doubt the appetite is there for a reason. And for a lot of folks, the convenience, the accessibility of for-profit schools really makes sense for them, especially if you know exactly what you need to go into that line of work or to change your line of work. And if you're really determined to take out only what you need and you're determined to make use of that degree, that's how it makes sense.
I know the unemployment rate is pretty high anyway, but for recent grads, it's even higher, right? I think it's like double the unemployment rate.
It's double, yeah.
Yeah. Is a degree, Carmen, still worthwhile?
Absolutely, without a doubt. Looking at the unemployment rate of recent college grads, it's one stat. And yes, it's kind of a dire stat. It's over around 24% unemployment.
Yeah.
But looking historically and down the line, you still will make so much more money than someone with just a high school degree. And also, if you look at the jobs where not only is there highest pay for graduates, such as engineering, but if you look at where the job growth is in the healthcare industry especially, you need college degrees to participate in that workforce. And as we decline as a country and a nation in terms of manufacturing, and we go to intellectual capital, that's just going to become more and more necessary.
Carmen Wong Ulrich is a personal finance journalist and author of The Real Cost of Living. Carmen, great conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
It's the time of the year for college graduates to get their diplomas and hear commencement speakers talk about taking risks and finding their inner muse. So here's Marketplace economics editor Chris Farrell with advice of his own.
Save early, save often. Okay, that catchphrase is hardly designed to bring goosebumps running up the spine of any audience. But it could. Think about it. Savings offers folks the opportunity to try several careers and multiple jobs over a lifetime. Savings gives us the practical freedom to translate passions into choices. Unfortunately, over the past three decades with the rise of the 401k, savings has become synonymous with retirement. Savings is something to be tapped in a distant time when we're much older. Well, that's wrong. Savings should be geared toward funding transitions over a lifetime and not just the last third. In practical terms, this means setting up an automatic savings program that regularly puts money, no matter how little, into taxable accounts. Set it up right away with your first job after graduating. The same holds if you're a 40-something or 50-something worker. Here's the thing. Transitions are rarely easy and usually expensive. Whether you're in your 20s, your 40s, or your 60s, it takes time to find a new job and a different career. Sure, you've all probably seen or heard the cover story about someone who fled their $40,000-a-year dead-end job and a year later has found joy owning their own rare vintage vineyard, muse to chefs everywhere. But for the rest of us, transitions are a period of trial and error, experimentation and effort, as we look for work that gives us greater meaning, allows us to use our talents to improve our community, and provide an income. Yet that's the task millions and millions of people have given themselves, from newly minted college graduates seeking their first full-time job to aging baby boomers trying to establish their third career. A program of safe savings gives everyone a measure of control in an uncertain world. Who knows where the stock market will be a decade from now or in three decades? A system of savings allows you to take risks and change course as your passions shift. That's a hefty return on investment in my book.
Chris Farrell is Marketplace Economics Editor. Time once again for your questions, and helping us out this week is Kathy Kristoff from Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Kathy, thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Glad you're here in the studio with us. I want to talk for a moment about this study that I saw by the National Bureau of Economic Research. It's a working paper, really, and it shows a pretty gloomy picture, Kathy, of American household finances. This survey says, among a whole host of other things, a lot of folks are missing the boat on retirement. They're not thinking about retirement soon enough. They're not putting away enough money. And most importantly, and this is what really caught my attention, not having the capability to put enough money away for those latter years. 1 in 10 people said they'd tapped into a 401k or some other retirement fund like an IRA.
Right.
I know people like to live in the moment. And especially if you're young, and of course I was like this as well, you're not thinking about retirement. But why is it so hard for people to think about their latter years?
Well, I think it's hard to visualize what you're going to be like, what things are going to be, what you're going to need to do, how much you're going to need to spend on all that stuff, because it's so far away. And, you know, when you talk about this 1 in 10 people tapping their retirement accounts, yeah, that's a practical thing. I mean, look at the unemployment rate right now. It's about equal, right?
Yeah.
So what do? Do you keep that money in your retirement plan, or do you actually use it to eat today so that you get to retirement? I don't think it's necessarily an illogical choice.
You know, the survey is so interesting. A quarter of the people who responded said they had used a pawn shop or some sort of payday loan to help them get by. This is 25%.
Yeah, that's kind of scary. I mean, the pawn shop loans, frankly, are better than the payday loans.
Yeah.
But the payday loans are just a really frightening,
yeah, it's
outrageous
a really high
trap.
Percentage, yeah, high yeah. percentage interest that you have to pay back. About a fifth of respondents said they didn't know what their interest rates were on their auto loans or their credit card balances.
I think that the credit card companies are really brilliant in getting you to – in distracting you
yeah.
from looking at the interest rate by giving you rewards. Oh, hey, look over here, the shiny little bright thing we've got for you. You know, oh, we're going to give you this thing free.
Airline seats, yes.
Yes, exactly. And as long as you pay that interest on your continuing balance, of course, you're paying – really high amount.
Tenfold for that airline seat. Yeah,
yeah exactly. Yeah. That free thing that they just gave you, that magazine subscription or whatever it was. It's like, oh, good heavens.
Yeah. I want to head to the phone lines now. I think Evan has actually a question about credit. He's calling us from Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi, Evan.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. What do you do there in Sin City?
I'm a lighting technician at a show on the Las Vegas Strip.
Oh, really? What show?
Wow. Let's say I work at a good show.
He wants to be shy. Okay, that's fine. We want to keep Evan anonymous then in Las Vegas. How did you get started doing that?
Well, it's the only thing I've ever wanted to do, and I've been working towards it my whole life. And about 4 years ago, I went through a divorce and said, heck with it. It's time to go to Las Vegas and find my dream job.
There you go.
Cool.
Yeah, very nice. So what can we do for you today?
It seems these days that credit scores affect a lot more things than how you're going to get a loan. And when I went through my divorce, I had a little trouble, a couple of late payments and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, I've cleaned everything up. I've eliminated all of my bills, and I'm not paying any bills, so my credit score keeps going down.
That is actually a common problem. You'd be surprised at how many people have that, because you need to have credit to get good credit.
Right.
You know what I would recommend, Evan, is do get a credit card, get a rewards card, and use it and just pay off the balance every month.
Oh, I do that, but it's not really helping.
Really?
Hmm.
Because I have no utility bills or anything like that, and so the only credit I have is a credit card, and that's it. The only thing I can see to do is take out loans I don't need and pay interest I don't need to pay to get my credit score up.
Well, you know what? When you don't need loans, you don't really care what your credit score is, right?
Well, the only reason I care anymore is because now they're talking about things like job opportunities and car insurance bills and stuff like that.
They check your credit at some jobs, right?
Exactly.
Absolutely do.
So now my credit score is going down, which is going to affect all sorts of things that have nothing to do with my credit.
Well, how bad is your credit score?
Well, this last quarter, it went from 650 to 624.
Okay, then you do need to worry about it. You know, there are a handful of things that affect your credit score. One of them is the different types of credit you have. So if you have a car loan, if you have a home loan, if you had credit cards, that variety helps your score. So you don't have a home loan, you don't want a home loan. The challenge with you is that your past credit matters. It's still on your credit report for at least 7 years, right?
Right.
And so if you had those loans in the past and didn't handle them well, that's going to work against your credit score until you get a new car loan or until you get a new home loan. And so the only other thing you can do is get more credit cards with big credit limits and don't use them.
Okay, well, I have probably about a $20,000 in credit card limit, and I'm using about $100.
Okay.
So I guess I'll just keep getting more credit cards and not using them.
There's your advice today, Evan. Get more credit cards. This from the personal finance show.
Well, you know, the problem is there's just a very limited number of things that you can do if you don't want credit. The other thing you can do is just simply pay your bills on time and wait for those bad things that happened while you're divorced to evaporate. Fair Isaacs has a good little widget on their
site. Fair Isaacs is the FI and FICO.
Right, yeah. FI and FICO. They have a little primer on their website that will help you figure out what you can do to affect your credit score. It might be worth it to go there, kind of study it, see if there's anything that you're not doing that you're willing to do. Because, you know, really what we're talking about here is that you know what you can do, but you don't want to do those things. And so until you have a problem that's caused by your credit score, I think you just make a very limited attempt to affect it.
Okay, great.
All right, Evan. Good luck to you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate your help.
Let's take another call right now from Marietta in Chicago. Marietta, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Doing well. So what can we help you out with today?
So I am 23 years old, and right now I'm a union organizer. But before, I was going to school at Columbia College in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I made the mistake of taking my entire tuition and room and board out for the 2 years I was there in private student loans.
And so did you not know that you could get federal student loans?
Well, I don't know if I even qualified for them, to be honest. I wasn't as responsible as I should have been at the age of 17 and 18 when I was going into school.
Yeah, actually, everybody can qualify for federal student loans.
So, Marietta, you took out these loans. How much are we talking about here?
Well, the original principal was about $30,000, but the interest rate on three of them was about 12% for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it just went down to 9.75%. But unfortunately, there was a year where I took a sabbatical from school and was not able to start paying it off. So I've accrued a large amount of interest, and I'm up to $63,000 for the total of all four loans.
Ouch.
Yes, okay. And it hurts a lot. So right now I'm paying $500 a month, and it only goes to keeping down my interest. Like, none of that is hitting my principal right now. So I just feel, you know, at the age of 23, like, what the heck am I going to do with all
mountain,
of these loans?
A mountain of debt right there.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Is $500 a month all you can pay against these loans, or all you can afford to pay against these loans right now?
Right now it is.
Okay.
Exactly.
And have you talked to your lender about whether they would be willing to restructure your loan, reduce your interest rate now that you have a regular job and, I'm assuming, pretty good credit?
That is what I'm hoping to do. I wanted to get some sort of financial advice before I went in to talk to them, because it's through Sallie Mae, and I feel like right now I don't have any leverage. You know, they're just going to do what they can to make sure they can keep getting my money. So I wanted to see what my options would be in, like, consolidating or restructuring or refinancing or anything like that.
Have you ever gone on the peer-to-peer lending sites?
I have not.
You might want to check that out.
Is this LendingTree and these other places?
Right.
Yeah.
There are a variety of, and you could just look it up on peer-to-peer on a Google search, lending sites. You might be able to refinance it that way. I don't know if you have any relatives that have cash that would be willing to, like, you know, because when you're talking about lending money at 9%, that's a really high interest rate, right? And if your parents have money in the bank and that they're earning 2% on, if you paid them 5%, they're getting a great deal and you're getting a great deal, right?
Yeah.
And
right.
If you can sock that against those loans, now all of a sudden you have a completely different picture in how much you can afford and how much principal you're going to be paying against those loans. So I don't know that at 23 you have enough credit history to get another type of loan without it being kind of a peer-to-peer or friend-to-friend sort of loan.
Yeah, certainly not $63,000. That's, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. $63,000 is a lot of money. And the reason why a student lender will give you that is because they know that it's going to follow you around until you're, you know, 95. And they don't have any concern about it being discharged in bankruptcy or restructured. So that's where I would probably look.
Are you are you back in school, Marietta?
No, I'm not. I'm considering going back to DePaul University. They have an online program that I can stay at my job full time and go to classes online when I can.
So you've got this mountain of debt that you're under, and you don't have the degree.
Exactly. That's what kills me every single time is, I was going for theater, which, again, was not the most responsible decision. But I went to theater school for 2 years, have no degree. And I have a really great job, and I'm lucky to be where I am, and I'm doing really well at it. But I still don't have any sort of bachelor's degree at all.
Yeah. You know what? Let me suggest, too, on schools, look at Western Governors University.
Okay.
It's an online university. It's a nonprofit. And what they do is they allow you to go through school at whatever pace you want to go. And it's very, very low cost. I think of all the online universities, it's the one that you could recommend without any caveats.
That's fantastic. And that's what I've been really nervous about is I don't want to take a break from working because so much of it is based on experience. But I've always been wary of going to an online school and then having a piece of paper that doesn't really mean anything.
These guys are regionally accredited, which is something you need to pay attention to. A lot of the online universities are nationally accredited, which does not have the same weight. And sometimes those units are not transferable. These guys, everything's transferable. I've been very impressed with the school.
Oh, fantastic. I'll have to look into them.
Marietta, does that do it for you?
Yeah, it does. Thank you guys so much for your help. I really appreciate it.
Good luck on that college education, too, all right?
Thanks
get the
so
degree.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank
bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Let's go back to the phones, and James is calling us now from Minneapolis. Hi, James.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
Doing well. Say hi to Kathy.
Hey, Kathy.
Hey, how are you?
Not too bad.
James, what can we help you out with today?
Well, I'm kind of calling for your professional career advice. I've been working for a small franchise company for 4 years now. I'm 28 years old, and I work for the corporate element managing their wholesale. When I started, their wholesale department was kind of piecemeal, and it was a part-time job. But since then, I've helped grow this into a fairly respectable revenue stream, and they're bringing in more resources to develop that wholesale program. The problem is, in 4 years, I have not seen a pay increase. And on last week's show, someone referenced a cost of living increase, and I'm wondering if it seems like cost of living has gone up every year and now is no different, if I should at some point, working for an hourly wage, I'm at $13 an hour and I'm the only hourly employee in the company, if maybe I should have seen some sort of cost of living increase or a raise by this point.
Do they have to pay him a COLA?
As long as you're over minimum wage, nobody has to do anything, right?
Yeah.
But let me ask you, why are you the only hourly employee? Have you inquired?
No, not explicitly, but the sense I have is that because I was originally a part-time employee in a department that didn't really perform much, if it's not broke, don't fix it. That's kind of the way I feel that they've approached it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great job. I do have benefits, medical insurance, and I'm always wary to, in this job market, let go of something that it does keep me afloat. You know, I'm single, I don't have a family, so there's not a ton to support. But at the same time, I'm wondering if perhaps I could do better than I'm doing, because without seeing a cost of living increase or a raise that hasn't been brought to my attention in 4 years, I'm kind of starting to feeling a little underappreciated.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I mean, the best way to deal with being or feeling underappreciated is to not be, is stand up and say, hey, guess what? This is what I'm doing, and this is what I think it's worth. And so go and spend some time, you know, just at your dining room table, making a list of what you do there and how you have helped the company's bottom line. And then also start looking around a little bit and see what you could do at another company. You know, we just talked about this whole, you know, negotiating posture, and your negotiating position is so much better when you have options.
Yeah.
You may really like this company and not want to leave, but if you have the option of leaving, all of a sudden you become much more attractive. You know, play hard to get. Right?
I hear the Rocky music in the background here. This is cool. You need to start climbing those steps there.
You got the final countdown, yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, you just need to say, hey, I really like you guys, but I need to look out for me too, because that's your job.
Yeah, certainly keep your options open and look at these other places that are out there. Put your resumes out there. I mean, that's not gonna hurt.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And then when you go in and you actually talk to them, it may be that they underappreciate you because you've never asked for anything more.
Okay.
So ask politely. Don't be, you know, aggressive about it, but just say, hey, I feel like the world is passing me by here and I need to, you know, see what I can do. And you might be surprised. They might go, oh, gosh, yeah, we just never really thought about it. You didn't ask.
Right. Well, I'll go get the Rocky soundtrack then.
You should do that. I have a tiger, my friend. I have a tiger. That's all
it.
I can tell you. So, all right, James, good luck
to
you.
Thank you.
Appreciate
all right,
it.
Take all care. Right. We're always here to take your money questions anytime. You can call us. The toll-free number is 1-877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. We spell money, M-O-N-Y. You can also send us an email at the Getting Personal link at our website, marketplace.org. And Kathy, again, thanks.
Well, thank you.
A lot of fun. Remember to always check with your financial professional, too, before making any big-time money decisions.
Marketplace Money is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Comer Science and Education Foundation, dedicated to supporting innovative programs making a positive impact on the lives of individuals and communities. The Marketplace Economy 4.0 series is supported by the Kelly School of Business at Indiana University, providing a tailored approach to business education and career advancement. Learn more at kellei.iu.edu.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Bobby J. Brown. I am from Bladensburg, Maryland. Right now I'm in Washington, D.C. at the Union Station. My wallet looks like a little case, like a little cigarette case with a zip-up that you carry on the side of you. I carried that because I had my identity stolen from me, my wallet stolen from me in 1985. So for my security, I feel much more comfortable with that. I carry my ID, my medical, my driver's license, and I have about one or two, like $5 in ones, that's all. Hand sanitizer and chewing gum, you know, emergency little money right there just in case, right? And on the outside, another two or three little dollars, you know, bank card, grocery card, my prepaid legal associate business card, and my credentials. That's it.
This week, Harvard University released a report on real estate in the United States. Home construction is way off, and the housing market is deeply depressed. One bright spot of the report, lower rental vacancy rates. Apparently, renters are back. In China, though, it is quite the opposite. Homes are going up everywhere over there, and people are buying. Marketplace host Kai Rizdal has been reporting the last couple of weeks from China. He's with us now from Shanghai with more on that. Hey, Kai.
Hey, Steve.
What's going on with the real estate market over there?
Well, I'll tell you what, the better question is really what's not going on with the real estate market over here. It is absolutely crazy. We have been in Shanghai. We've been out in Chongqing, out in Sichuan province, way out west. We've talked to a lot of different homeowners on pretty much the whole spectrum of property around here. And it's just different. People are buying property as places to live. They're buying it as investments. Prices are still going up, even though the government is trying to control things and even though the government is adding to the housing supply here. And the homeownership rate is something like 80%. I mean, it's a thing that people do here is buy houses.
I thought there was a lot of poverty in China, Kai. Isn't it just the rich who can afford to buy?
Yeah, actually not so. And it goes all up and down the spectrum. We talked to a construction worker out in Chongqing a couple of days ago. He's a contractor, actually. He does, you know, interior renovations on some of these apartments. He owns his own place. He owns the place next door. He's got a tenant in one of his units. He's collecting income from that. We talked to a 24-year-old kid here in Shanghai last week before we left. He also has property. That's just what people do here. And here's how they do it. They save. So this contractor that we met out in Chongqing, Mr. Li is his name, he makes, you know, plus or minus 8,000 Chinese renminbi a month. That's like $1,000, $1,200. Really not a bad living at all. Monthly living expenses, like $300 or $400. So he banks the rest of it. I mean, this guy puts 60% of his income in the bank. And that's how, when they buy property, a lot of Chinese do it, in cash.
So they save and save and save, Kai. Why such a boom?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is obviously the booming Chinese economy, as you know. There is just more wealth here, right? And people need a place to put that cash. Part of it is because of the rapid urbanization of this country. People are moving from the farms into the cities by the millions. And the government, frankly, needs some place to put them. So the government's building housing like it's going out of style. They're going to build out in Chongqing, where we were until yesterday. They are going to build 10 million square meters. That's 90 million square feet of housing a year for the next 10 years. Also, though, it's that saving thing, right? People don't like to put their money in the banks here. They don't trust it. They just want something tangible. And what they do with it is they do in what in Chinese is called a touzi. They invest, and they invest in property.
Sounds like a bubble guy.
Yeah, well, you know, so that's the question I've been asking everybody, right? Because given where we've come from in the States in the past 5 years with housing, I literally say to people, but aren't you worried about what happens when the bubble bursts? But they look me straight in the eye. Like this 24-year-old kid in Shanghai we talked to the other day. He literally said to me, I am never going to lose money in the Shanghai real estate market, ever. Right. I mean, that's what this kid believes. And, you know, so the argument is, of course, that the rules here are different, that there is such a demand. People by the millions coming into the cities, they have to have someplace to put them. There is no shortage of demand for housing here. And also the government's putting new rules in. Right. They're trying to slow things down. You have to put 30% down at least on a house. Most people, though, pay cash. So the basic financial situation going into the property market is usually stronger. You don't have those liar loans that we had in the States, for example, and the bad documentation and the people, you know, getting in way over their heads. It's tough to believe it's not a bubble, but, you know, I have not found a single person here who's worried about a bubble anytime soon, Steve.
Kai, thanks. Safe travels.
Thanks, man. See you soon.
You can see pictures and read about Kai's trip to China, by the way, at marketplace.org.
What a drag it is getting old.
The weak economy has forced some baby boomers to stay in the workforce longer, and that's created a new office dynamic. A survey by CareerBuilder says more than 40% of workers older than 35 have a younger boss. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
It's easy to imagine how this could go badly. You've got a 60-some-year-old employee, stubbornly set in his cumbersome paper-filling out ways, reporting to a 20-some-year-old boss who thinks she knows it all already and knows she wants work done on the computer immediately. Bye-bye Birdie runs in a loop through the old-timer's head.
Why can't they be like we were, perfect in every way? What's the matter with kids today?
Black Eyed Peas is thumping in the head of the know-it-all upstart.
Checking my account, logging in and logging out, baby, I want it. This is the now generation.
Bring the two together, and you might expect a discordant mess.
Good morning, give me more money.
But experts and real-life employees say that's not really how it plays out. For the most part, age differences in the workforce don't create the problems that stereotypes would have us believe, because a lot of the stereotypes aren't true.
The extent to which differences either in age or in some cases it's framed as generations have been a bit overblown.
Marcy Pitt Katsoufis heads the Sloan Center on Aging and Work at Boston College. She says research shows that many of the perceptions we have about younger and older workers just aren't right. Older employees can be technically savvy. Young people can be good communicators. But the stereotypes still matter.
Because even though they're just perceptions or attitudes, is it kind of shapes a little bit how the workplace may end up responding to people of different age groups.
And the stereotypes pop up in some surprising ways. Evan Hagberg is 27. He owns and runs a utility service company in Ohio. His office is filled with trade tools, zone maps, wire gauges, and
a dog warning board over there, and that's the dangerous dogs to look out for in certain things in the field.
Many of his 15 employees are more than twice his age. Hagberg says he hasn't run into many generation gap issues. But there was one time when he was doing a hiring interview and the interviewee asked to meet the manager.
When I informed him that I, in fact, owned the company, he got a quizzical look on his face and leaned back and said, I'm sorry, I don't think I necessarily want to work for your company, but thank you very much for the opportunity.
Hagberg hired someone else.
Many of our older workers are the most effective and proficient technicians that we have.
Good work relations seem to have a lot more to do with individuals than age differences. Sure, there are the things that really young bosses might not understand immediately, like why everyone can't just stay at work till 2 and sleep on the floor when things get really busy. But good managers learn.
I can have good managers that are older, good managers that are younger. It really just depends on the person.
Skip Sanchez is 64 years old. He works in finance. He says in the last 10 years, most of his supervisors have been younger than he is, and he kind of likes it.
I think it keeps me younger, younger thinking, and I enjoy being around younger people.
Sanchez isn't an outlier. Generational gaps alone don't create that many problems in functioning workplaces. According to that Career Builder survey, only about 5% of workers older than 55 say they don't like taking directions from a younger boss. It turns out the people who least like their younger bosses are the younger employees. But that's another story. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace Money.
Now we turn to another possible conflict, not at work, but at home. It's not easy sharing an apartment with a roommate. I can think of some horror stories. One time my roommate put a pound of ham in the silverware drawer, honestly. What a surprise that was. Well, here's something not so surprising. Money is at the center of a lot of roommate squabbles. Stacey Rapikon is a reporter at Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
What do you do to determine if a potential roommate is, I don't know, financially qualified to move in?
Well, if you don't already know the person you're going to move in with, if it's not already a friend or somebody you're familiar with, you want to make sure you do a thorough interview with them. Just ask them a lot of questions about maybe what they do, maybe not necessarily how much they earn. That's a little personal, but just make sure that they're employed, they seem responsible, and make sure you get along. Also, some management companies, if your landlord does this, they can run background checks on potential roommates or potential tenants, and that will include a credit check as well as a criminal record or anything.
I keep hearing about something called a roommate agreement. Is that some sort of binding contract?
Well, it can be as legal or as casual as you want it to be. It's basically just talking about before you even move in, before you sign a lease together, talking about how you'll deal with your living situation. You'll discuss how much the rent will be, when everything will be due. And if you want to legalize it, if you want to get it signed and notarized, you can do that just in case, you know, problems escalate into a legal battle.
What options do you have if a roommate, say, bails on a lease?
Well, that's something you'd want to cover in a roommate agreement beforehand or just discuss casually if you don't want to go ahead with a formal roommate agreement. Just talk about, you know, when the lease ends and any repercussions somebody will have if they want to cut out early. Maybe they'll have to cover the security deposit that you won't get anymore, or they'll have to help you find a replacement roommate before they take off.
How would that be enforced?
Well, if you have a notarized roommate agreement, that you'll be able to take to a lawyer and they'll have to enforce it. Otherwise, a lot of this is just about trust. That is the deal with roommates or with any business relationship you have. This is really a business relationship that you're setting up.
Now, I've seen some websites, Stacey, that have popped up that actually help people determine who should pay what in rent in some sort of roommate situation, right? So maybe for a bigger bedroom or a walk-in closet, you pay a little more money in rent or a better view perhaps. Does that help, do you think?
Yeah, it all depends on what you and your roommates decide is fair. WePay.com is a money management site that can help you decide how to divvy up the costs that you'll share. A lot of people do agree that if there is a bigger room involved, that the person taking that room should pay more. But it's really up to you. Whatever you all decide is fair. I had a roommate once, and we had split up. We had a two-bedroom apartment, mm-hmm. and I wound up in the much, much bigger master bedroom. I had a view of tennis courts, and it was just a lot bigger, a lot nicer. I mean, not nicer, but it was a lot bigger.
It was as nice as it could be in that apartment.
It was a great place, and she took the smaller room. But we decided to not quibble over how much each room was worth. We decided to split the rent evenly. And what happened was she took over most of the common area and used it as her office space. She also ended up having a couple of dogs over all the time, which was fine with me, you know.
More roommates.
Exactly. But we just decided what was fair and we stuck with it. The real important thing is that you discuss everything beforehand and you come to a mutual agreement and you stick by what you decide to do.
Stacey Rappacon with Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Stacey, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Question. When you're shopping, have you ever noticed when there are more choices, you're more likely to get a better deal? Competition brings prices down. Makes sense? Or does it? Sally Herships has more.
Hershad Chatto is a computer science student from Virginia. He needs a new laptop.
With which I can play games.
And for video games, he needs a computer with a lot of processing power. So Chatto is checking out his options. We're at B&H Photo in New York, in an aisle full of computers. The store is enormous. It takes up an entire city block. It even has conveyor belts running along the ceiling to move merchandise between departments. Chatto was looking at an HP laptop. How much is the one, the HP?
It was around 900.
But there's a long aisle of laptops to choose from. And now he's standing in front of another computer.
And this one looks different because it has dual screen. So this is the first time I'm looking at a dual screen.
The laptop with the second screen would be 25% more than the HP he had his eye on. So Chatto says he needs to do some more research. And this is where things get interesting. Normally, more options means a greater chance for a better deal. But Columbia professor Sheena Iyengar says this rule doesn't apply when a product is high-end, like a computer. She recently published a study on how consumers make choices. When there are more choices for something expensive, Iyengar says consumers focus less on price.
What becomes more important to me are some other attributes that define the differences between these products.
She says, say you're shopping for a really nice bottle of wine, and there are a lot of choices. So when I'm looking at the expensive bottle of wine, all of a sudden I become hyper aware of all the nuances. The red from France versus the south of France.
How spicy it is, how much tannin, how smooth is the finish, etc.
And the result of all this attention to detail?
The price of wine was going up.
Iyengar says when there are more choices for something consumers think of as a major purchase, they'll pay more. But when items are low-end, normal economic rules kick in. That means more competition creates lower prices. And Iyengar says, with cheaper items, consumers focus almost solely on price. So retailers selling less expensive products should offer fewer choices, right? Turns out, it's not that simple. Take Walmart.
They cut back a little too much.
Jeff Weidauer is president of marketing and strategy for Vestcom International, a marketing company for the retail industry. He says companies don't want to carry lots of choices. Storage is expensive, and so is carrying items that don't sell. So retailers try to decide which products to carry using a method called SKU rationalization.
Which is a big term for stores removing the size of the selection in a given category. They might go from 18 types of toothpaste down to 12.
But Walmart had a tricky time with it.
And they found out that some of the products that weren't selling as well, those were bringing in customers, though, who were buying other things.
When customers couldn't find what they wanted at Walmart, they stopped coming in.
As a result, they had to put some of those products back on the shelf.
Columbia professor Sheena Iyengar says when it comes to how many products should be on store shelves, there's a magic range of numbers, 15 to 20. She says consumers can only handle that many categories. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us on Facebook, and I hope you'll follow me on Twitter at Radio Chio. Next time, they call economics the dismal science. For some financial workers, it really is.
It is an absolute weakness to have to say to your friends, oh, I'm headed to my therapist. I've got to leave work early tonight. And these are a bunch of guys sitting around trading desks saying, excuse me, where the heck are you going?
Right.
Therapy? What?
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Nancy Fargali, Devin Robbins, and Sonata Lee Narsis. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Steve Chiatakis. We'll see you next week. This is APM, American Public Media.